You're not going to be able to tunnel through to him, if that is what you're thinking, Yarblick said, also standing and brushing the sand off the skirts of his overcoat. You don't have the time. Belgareth's eyes were narrowed with thought. Thanks, Yarblick. You have been a good friend. Anything to irritate the Murgos, the Nedric said. I wish I could do something for Silk. You don't give up on him yet. There's not much hope, I'm afraid. I had better be going, though. My people will wander off if I am not there to watch them.
Yarblick, Beric said, holding out his hand. Someday we will have to get together and finish getting drunk.
Yarblick grinned at him and shook his hand. Then he turned and caught Aunt Paul in a rough embrace.
If you ever get bored with these Alorns, girl, my tent flap is always open to you.
I will keep that in mind, Yarblick, she replied demurely.
Luck, Yarblick told them. I'll wait for you until midnight.
Then he turned and strode off down the gully.
That's a good man there, Beric said. I think I could actually get to like him.
We must make plans for Prince Keldar's rescue,
Mandarallan declared, beginning to take his armor out of the packs strapped to one of the horses.
Or else failing, we must of necessity resort to main force.
You're backsliding again, Mandarallan, Beric said.
That's already been taken care of,
Belgareth told them. And Mandarallan stared at him.
Put your armor away, Mandarallan,
the old man instructed the knight.
You're not going to need it.
Who's going to go get Silk out of there, then? Beric demanded.
I am, Relg answered quietly. How much longer is it going to be before it gets dark?
About an hour. Why?
I'll need some time to prepare myself.
Have you got a plan, then? Dernick asked.
Relg shrugged.
There isn't any need. We'll just circle around until we're behind that hill on the other side of the encampment. I will go get our friend, and then we can leave.
Just like that?
More or less. Please, excuse me.
Relg started to turn away.
Wait a minute. Shouldn't Mandarallan and I go with you?
You wouldn't be able to follow me, Relg told him.
He walked up the gully a short distance. After a moment, they could hear him muttering his prayers.
Does he think he can pry him out of that pit?
Beric sounded disgusted.
No, Belgareth replied. He's going to go through the hill and carry Silk back out. That's why he was asking Yarblick all of those questions.
He's going to what?
You saw what he did at Prolgu, when he stuck his arm into the wall.
Well, yes, but
it is quite easy for him, Brack.
What about Silk? How is he going to pull him through the rock?
I don't really know. He seems quite sure that he can do it, though.
If it doesn't work, Tar Urgas is going to have Silk roasting over a slow fire first thing tomorrow morning. You know that, don't you?
Belgareth nodded somberly. Barak shook his head.
It is unnatural, he grumbled.
Don't let it upset you so much.
The light began to fade, and Relg continued to pray, his voice rising and falling in formal cadence. When it was fully dark, he came back to where the others waited.
I'm ready. We could leave now?
We'll circle to the west,
Belgareth told them.
We'll lead the horses and stay under cover as much as we can.
It'll take us a couple of hours, then, Dernick said.
That's all right. It will give the soldiers time to settle down. Paul, see what the Grolems Geryon saw are up to.
She nodded, and Geryon felt the gentle push of her probing mind.
It's all right, Father, she stated after a few moments. They are preoccupied. Tar Urgas has them conducting services for him.
Well, let's go, then, the old man said.
They moved carefully down the gully, leading the horses. The night was murky, and the wind bit at them as they came out from between the protecting gravel banks. The plain to the east of the fair was dotted with 100 fires, whipping in the wind and marking the vast encampment of the army of Tawaragos. Relg grunted and covered his eyes with his hands.
"What's wrong?"
Garion asked him.
"The fires. They stab at my eyes."
"Try not to look at them."
"My God has laid a hard burden on me, Belgarion," Relg sniffed then, and wiped at his nose with his sleeve. "I'm not meant to be out in the open like this."
"You had better have Aunt Paul give you something for that cold. It will taste awful, but you will feel better after you drink it."
"Perhaps," Rug said, still shielding his eyes from the dim flicker of the Murgol watchfires.
The hill on the south side of the fair was a low outcropping of granite. Although aeons of constant wind had covered it for the most part with a thick layer of blown sand and dirt, the rock itself lay solid beneath its covering mantle. They stopped behind it, and Relg began carefully to brush the dirt from a sloping granite face.
"Wouldn't it be closer if you started over there?" Beric asked quietly. "There's too much dirt," Relg replied. "Dirt or rock, what is the difference?" "A great difference that you wouldn't understand."
He leaned forward and put his tongue to the granite face, seeming actually to taste the rock.
"This is going to take a while," he said.
He drew himself up, began to pray, and slowly pushed himself directly into the rock.
Varak shuddered and quickly averted his eyes.
"What ails thee, my lord?"
Andoralan asked.
"It makes me cold all over just watching that," Varak replied.
"Our new friend is perhaps not the best of companions, but if this gift succeeds in freeing Prince Skeldar, I will embrace him gladly and call him brother."
"If it takes him very long, we're going to be awfully close to this spot when morning comes and Tar-Urgas finds out that Silk is gone."
"We will just have to wait and see what happens then," Dalgarath told them.
The night dragged by interminably. The wind moaned and whistled around the rocks on the flanks of the stony hill, and the sparse thorn bushes rustled stiffly. They waited. A growing fear oppressed Garion as the hours passed. More and more he became convinced that they had lost Relg as well as Silk. He felt that same sick emptiness he had felt when it had been necessary to leave the wounded Leldorn behind, back in Arindia. He realized, feeling a bit guilty about it, that he had not thought about Leldoran in months. He began to wonder how well the young hothead had recovered from his wound, or even if he had recovered. His thoughts grew bleaker as the minutes crawled. Then, with no warning, with not even a sound, Relg stepped out of the rock face he had entered hours before. Astride his broad back and clinging desperately to him was Silk. The rat-faced little man's eyes were wide with horror, and his hair seemed to be actually standing on end. They all crowded around the two, trying to keep their jubilation quiet, conscious of the fact that they were virtually on top of an army of Murgos.
"I'm sorry it took so long," Relg said,
jerking his shoulders uncomfortably until Silk finally slid off of his back.
"There's a different kind of rock in the middle of the hill. I had to make certain adjustments."
Silk stood, gasping and shuddering uncontrollably. Finally, he turned on Relg.
"Don't ever do that to me again," he blurted.
"Not ever." "What's the trouble?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"I had feared we had lost thee, my friend," Mandarallan said, grasping Silk's hand.
"How did Bril catch you?"
Barak asked.
"I was careless. I did not expect him to be here. Ismin threw a net over me as I was galloping through a ravine. My horse fell and broke his neck."
"Hertha's not going to like that."
"I will cut the price of the horse out of Bril's skin. Someplace close to the bone, I think."
"Why does Tar-Urgas hate you so much?"
Beric asked curiously. I was in Rakoska a few years ago. A Tolnedran agent made a few false charges against me. I never found out exactly why. Tar Ugas sent some soldiers to arrest me. I did not particularly feel like being arrested, so I argued with the soldiers a bit. Several of them died during the argument. Those things happen once in a while. Unfortunately, one of the casualties was Tar Ugas's oldest son. The king of the Murgos took it personally. He's very narrow-minded sometimes.
Beric grinned. He'll be terribly disappointed in the morning when he finds out that you have left.
Oh, I know, Soak replied. He'll probably take this part of Skol Murgos apart, stone by stone, trying to find me.
I think it is time we left, Dolgareth agreed.
Oh, I thought you'd never get around to that, Soak said.
Chapter 23 They rode hard through the rest of the night and for most of the following day. By evening their horses were stumbling with exhaustion, and Geryon was as numb with weariness as with biting cold.
"We'll have to find shelter of some kind," Durnick said as they reined in to look for a place to spend the night.
They had moved up out of the series of connecting valleys through which the south caravan route wound, and had entered the ragged, barren wilderness of the mountains of Cenzrochthal Murgos. It had grown steadily colder as they had climbed into the vast jumble of rock and sand, and the endless wind moaned among the treeless crags. Durnick's face was creased with fatigue, and the gritty dust that drove before the wind had settled into the creases, etching them deeper.
"We can't spend the night in the open," he declared. "Not with this wind."
"Go that way,"
Relg said, pointing toward a rock fall on the steep slope they were climbing. His eyes were squinted almost shut, though the sky was still overcast and the fading daylight was pale.
"There's shelter there. A cave."
They had all begun to look at Relg in a somewhat different light since his rescue of Silk. His demonstration that he could, when necessary, take decisive action made him seem less an encumbrance and more like a companion. Belgarath had finally convinced him that he could pray on horseback just as well as he could on his knees, and his frequent devotions no longer interrupted their journey. His praying thus had become less an inconvenience and more a personal idiosyncrasy, somewhat like Mander Rollin's archaic speech or Silk's sardonic witticisms.
"You're sure there's a cave?"
Barak asked him. Relg nodded.
"I can feel it."
They turned and rode toward the rockfall. As they drew closer, Relg's eagerness became more obvious. He pushed his horse into the lead and nudged the tired beast into a trot, then a canter. At the edge of the rock slide, he swung down from his horse, stepped behind a large boulder, and disappeared.
"Looks as if he knew what he was talking about," Durnick observed. "I'll be glad to get out of this wind."
The opening to the cave was narrow, and it took some pushing and dragging to persuade the horses to squeeze through, but once they were inside, the cave widened out into a large, low-ceilinged chamber. Durnick looked around with approval.
"That's a good place."
He unfastened his axe from the back of the saddle.
"You'll need firewood."
"I'll help you,"
Geryon said.
"I'll go too," Silk offered quickly.
The little man was looking around at the stone walls and ceiling nervously, and he seemed obviously relieved as soon as the three of them were back outside.
"What's wrong?"
Durnick asked him.
"After last night, closed-in places make me a little edgy," Silk replied.
"What was it like?"
Geryon asked him curiously.
"Going through stone, I mean."
Silk shuddered.
"It was hideous.
We actually seeped into the rock. I could feel it sliding through me."
"It got you out, though," Durnick reminded him.
"I think I'd almost rather have stayed," Silk shuddered again. "Do we have to talk about it?"
Firewood was difficult to find on that barren mountainside, and even more difficult to cut.
The tough, springy thorn bushes resisted the blows of Durnik's axe tenaciously. After an hour, as darkness began to close in on them, they had gathered only 3 very scanty armloads of wood.
"Did you see anybody?"
Barak asked as they re-entered the cave.
"No,"
Silk replied.
"Tor Ulgas is probably looking for you."
"Oh, I'm sure of it."
Silk looked around.
"Where is Relg?"
"He went back into the cave to rest his eyes,"
Belgarath told him.
"He found water. Ice, actually. We will have to thaw it before we can water the horses."
Durnik's fire was tiny, and he fed it with twigs and small bits of wood, trying to conserve their meager fuel supply. It proved to be an uncomfortable night. In the morning, Aunt Paul looked critically at Relg.
"You don't seem to be coughing anymore," she told him. "How do you feel?"
"I'm fine,"
he replied, being careful not to look directly at her. The fact that she was a woman seemed to make him terribly uncomfortable, and he tried to avoid her as much as possible.
"What happened to that cold you had?"
"I don't think that it could go through the rock. It was gone when I brought him out of the hillside last night."
She looked at him gravely.
"I'd never thought of that," she mused. "No one has ever been able to cure a cold before."
"A cold isn't really that serious a thing, Balgara," Silk told her with a pained look.
"I'll guarantee you that sliding through rock is never going to be a popular cure."
It took them 4 days to cross the mountains to reach the vast basin Belgarath referred to as the wasteland of Murgos, and another half day to make their way down the steep basalt face to the black sand of the floor.
"What hath caused this, Yost de Prajant?"
Mandarallan asked, looking around at the barren expanse of scab rock, black sand, and dirty gray salt flats.
"There was an inland sea here once," Belgarath replied. "When Torak cracked the world, the upheaval broke away the eastern edge, and all of the water drained out."
"That must have been something to see," Barak said.
"We had other things on our minds just then."
"What's that?"
Garion asked in alarm, pointing at something sticking out of the sand just ahead of them. The thing had a huge head with a long, sharp-toothed snout. Its eye sockets, as big as buckets, seemed to stare balefully at them.
"I don't think it has a name," Belgarath answered calmly. "They lived in the sea before the water escaped. They have all been dead now for thousands of years."
As they passed the dead sea monster, Garion could see that it was only a skeleton. Its ribs were as big as the rafters of a barn, and its vast, bleached skull larger than a horse. The vacant eye sockets watched them as they rode past. Mandarallan, dressed once again in full armor, stared at the skull.
"A fearsome beast," he murmured.
"Look at the size of the teeth," Barak said in an awed voice. "It could bite a man in two with one snap."
"That happened a few times,"
Belgarath told him,
"until people learned to avoid this place."
They had moved only a few leagues out into the wasteland when the wind picked up, scouring along the black dunes under the slate-gray sky. The sand began to shift and move, and then, as the wind grew even stronger, it began to whip off the tops of the dunes, stinging their faces.
"We had better take shelter," Belgarath shouted over the shrieking wind. "This sandstorm's going to get worse as we move out farther from the mountains."
"Are there any caves around?"
Durnik asked Relg. Relg shook his head.
"None that we can use. They're all filled with sand."
"Over there,"
Barak pointed at a pile of scab rock rising from the edge of a salt flat.
"If we go to the leeward side, it will keep the wind off of us."
"No," Belgarath shouted. "We have to stay to the windward. The sand will pile up at the back. We could be buried alive."
They reached the rock pile and dismounted. The wind tore at their clothing, and the sand billowed across the wasteland like a vast black cloud.
"This is poor shelter, Belgarath,"
Barak roared, his beard whipping about his shoulders.
How long is this likely to last? A day. 2 days. Sometimes as long as a week.
Durnick had bent to pick up a piece of broken scab rock. He looked at it carefully, turning it over in his hands.
It's fractured into square pieces, he said, holding it up. It'll stack well. We can build a wall to shelter ourselves.
That will take quite a while, Barak objected.
Don't you have something else to do, then?
By evening, they had the wall up to shoulder height, and by anchoring the tents to the top of it, and higher up on the side of the rock pile, they were able to get in out of the worst of the wind. It was crowded, since they had to shelter the horses as well, but at least it was out of the storm. They huddled in their cramped shelter for 2 days, with the wind shrieking insanely around them, and the taut tent canvas drumming overhead. Then, when the wind finally blew itself out, and the black sand began to settle slowly, the silence seemed almost oppressive. As they emerged, Relg glanced up once, then covered his face and sank to his knees, praying desperately. The clearing sky overhead was a bright, chilly blue. Garion moved over to stand beside the praying fanatic.
It will be all right, Relg, he told him.
He reached out his hand without thinking.
Don't touch me,
Relg said and continued to pray. Silk stood, beating the dust and sand out of his clothing.
Do these storms come up often? He asked.
It is the season for them,
Belgareth replied.
Delightful, Silk said sourly.
Then a deep rumbling sound seemed to come from deep in the earth beneath them, and the ground heaved.
Earthquake, Belgareth warned sharply. Get the horses out of there.
Durnick and Barak dashed back inside the shelter and led the horses out from behind the trembling wall and onto the salt flat. After several moments, the heaving subsided.
It's Tuchik doing that, Silk demanded. Is he going to fight us with earthquakes and sandstorms?
Belgareth shook his head.
No. Nobody's strong enough to do that. That is what's causing it.
He pointed to the south. Far across the wasteland, they could make out a line of dark peaks. A thick plume was rising from one of them, towering into the air, boiling up in great black billows as it rose.
Volcano, the old man said. Probably the same one that erupted last summer and dropped all of the ash on Stithi's Tor.
A fire mountain?
Barak rumbled, staring at the great cloud that was growing up out of the mountaintop.
I've never seen one before.
That's 50 leagues away, Belgareth, Silk stated. Would it make the earth shake, even here?
The old man nodded.
The earth is all one piece, Silk. The force that's causing that eruption is enormous. It's bound to cause a few ripples. I think we had better get moving. Tar-Ogas patrols will be out looking for us again, now that the sandstorm's blown over. Which way do we go?
Durnick asked, looking around, trying to get his bearings.
That way.
Belgareth pointed toward the smoking mountain.
I was afraid you were going to say that,
Barak grumbled. They rode at a gallop for the rest of the day, pausing only to rest the horses. The dreary wasteland seemed to go on forever. The black sand had shifted and piled into new dunes during the sandstorm, and the thick-crusted salt flats had been scoured by the wind until they were nearly white. They passed a number of the huge, bleached skeletons of the sea monsters which had once inhabited this inland sea. The bony shapes appeared almost to be swimming up out of the black sand, and the cold, empty eye sockets seemed somehow hungry as they galloped past them. They stopped for the night beside another shattered outcropping of scab rock. Although the wind had died, it was still bitterly cold, and firewood was scanty. The next morning, as they set out again, Garion began to smell a strange, foul odor.
What is that stink? He asked.
The tarn of Thoth, Belgareth replied. It's all that's left of the sea that used to be here. It would have dried out centuries ago, but it is fed by underground springs. It smells like rotten eggs, Barak said. There is quite a bit of sulfur in the groundwater around here. I would not drink from the lake. I wasn't planning to, Barak said, wrinkling his nose.
The tarn of Toch was a vast, shallow pond, filled with oily-looking water that reeked like all of the dead fish in the world. Its surface steamed in the icy air, and the wisps of steam gagged them with a dreadful stink. When they reached the southern tip of the lake, Belgrath signaled for a halt.
This next stretch is dangerous, he told them soberly. Do not let your horses wander. Be sure you stay on solid rock. Ground that looks firm quite often won't be, and there are some other things we will need to watch out for. Keep your eyes on me and do what I do. When I stop, you stop. When I run, you run.
He looked thoughtfully at Relg. The Ulgo had bound another cloth across his eyes, partially to keep out the light and partially to hide the expanse of the sky above him.
I'll lead his horse, Grandfather,
Geryon offered.
Belgrath nodded. It's the only way, I suppose. He's going to have to get over that eventually, Barak said. Maybe. But this is not the time nor the place for it. Let's go.
The old man moved forward at a careful walk. The region ahead of them steamed and smoked as they approached it. They passed a large pool of gray mud that bubbled and fumed, and beyond it a sparkling spring of clear water, boiling merrily and cascading a scalding brook down into the mud.
At least it's warmer, Silk observed.
Mandarallan's face was steaming perspiration beneath his heavy helmet.
Oh, much warmer, he agreed.
Belgarath had been riding slowly, his head turned slightly as he listened intently.
Stop,
he said sharply. They all reined in. Just ahead of them, another pool suddenly erupted as a dirty gray geyser of liquid mud squirted 30 feet into the air. It continued to spout for several minutes, then gradually subsided.
Now, Belgarath barked, run!
He kicked his horse's flanks, and they galloped past the still-heaving surface of the pool, the hooves of their horses splashing in the hot mud that had splattered across the path. When they had passed, the old man slowed again, and once more rode with his ear cocked toward the ground.
What is he listening for?
Barak asked Palgara.
The geysers make a certain noise just before they erupt, she answered.
I didn't hear anything.
You don't know what to listen for.
Behind them, the mud geyser spouted again.
Geryon,
Aunt Paul snapped as he turned to look back at the mud plume rising from the pool.
Watch where you're going.
He jerked his eyes back. The ground ahead of him looked quite ordinary.
Back up, she told him.
Durnik, get the reins of Relg's horse.
Durnik took the reins, and Geryon began to turn his mount.
I said to back up.
Geryon's horse put one front hoof on the seemingly solid ground, and the hoof sank out of sight. The horse scrambled back and stood trembling as Geryon held him in tightly. Then, carefully, step by step, Geryon backed to the solid rock of the path they had followed.
Quicksand,
Silk said with a sharp intake of his breath.
It is all around us, Aunt Paul agreed. Don't wander off of the path, any of you.
Silk stared with a revulsion at the hoofprint of Geryon's horse disappearing on the surface of the quicksand.
How deep is it?
Deep enough,
Aunt Paul replied. They moved on, carefully picking their way through the quagmire and quicksand, stopping often as more geysers, some of mud, some of frothy boiling water, shot high into the air. By late afternoon, when they reached a low ridge of hard, solid rock beyond the steaming bog, they were all exhausted from the effort of the concentration it had taken to pass through that hideous region.
Do we have to go through any more like that?
Geryon asked.
No, Belgarath replied. It's just around the southern edges of the tarn.
Can one not go around it then?
Mandarallan inquired.
It is much longer if you do, and the bog helps to discourage pursuit.
What's that?
Relg cried suddenly.
What's what?
Barak asked him.
I heard something just ahead.
A kind of click. Like two pebbles knocking together.
Geryon felt a quick kind of wave against his face, almost like an unseen ripple in the air, and he knew that Aunt Paul was searching ahead of them with her mind.
Murgos, she said.
How many?
Belgorath asked her.
Six. And a Grolem. They are waiting for us just behind the ridge.
Only six?
Mandarallan said, sounding a little disappointed.
Barak grinned tightly. Light entertainment.
You're getting to be as bad as he is, Silk told the big Kerach.
Thinkest thou that we might need some plan, my lord? Mandarallan asked Barak.
Not really, Barak replied. Not for just six. Let's go spring their trap.
The two warriors moved into the lead, unobtrusively loosing their swords in their scabbards.
Has the sun gone down yet?
Relg asked Geryon.
It's just setting.
Relg pulled the binding from around his eyes and tugged down the dark veil. He winced and squinted his large eyes almost shut.
You're going to hurt them, Geryon told him. You ought to leave them covered until it gets dark.
I might need them,
Relg said, as they rode up the ridge toward the waiting Murgo ambush. The Murgos gave no warning. They rode out from behind a large pile of black rock and galloped directly at Mandarallan and Barak, their swords swinging. The two warriors, however, were waiting for them and reacted without that instant of frozen surprise which might have made the attack successful. Mandarallan swept his sword from its sheath, even as he drove his warhorse directly into the mount of one of the charging Murgos. He rose in his stirrups and swung a mighty blow downward, splitting the Murgo's head with his heavy blade. The horse, knocked off of his feet by the impact, fell heavily backward on top of his dying rider. Barak, also charging at the attackers, chopped another Murgo out of the saddle with three massive blows, spattering bright red blood on the sand and rock around them. A third Murgo sidestepped Mandarallan's charge and struck at the knight's back, but his blade clanged harmlessly off of the steel armor. The Murgo desperately raised his sword to strike again, but stiffened and slid from his saddle as Silk's skillfully thrown dagger sank into his neck, just below the ear. A dark-robed Grolem in his polished steel mask had stepped out from behind the rocks. Geryon could quite clearly feel the priest's exultation turning to dismay as Barak and Mandarallan systematically chopped his warriors to pieces. The Grolem drew himself up, and Geryon sensed that he was gathering his will to strike. But it was too late. Relg had already closed on him. The zealot's heavy shoulders surged as he grasped the front of the Grolem's robe with his knotted hands. Without apparent effort, he lifted and pushed the man back against the flattened face of a house-sized boulder. At first, it appeared that Relg only intended to hold the Grolem pinned against the rock until the others could assist him with the struggling captive. But there was a subtle difference. The set of his shoulders indicated that he had not finished the action he had begun with lifting the man from his feet. The Grolem hammered at Relg's head and shoulders with his fists, but Relg pushed at him inexorably. The rock against which the Grolem was pinned seemed to shimmer slightly around him.
Relg, no!
Silt's cry was strangled. The dark-robed Grolem began to sink into the stone face, his arms flailing wildly as Relg pushed him in with a dreadful slowness. As he went deeper into the rock, the surface closed smoothly over him. Relg continued to push, his arms sliding into the stone as he sank the Grolem deeper and deeper. The priest's two protruding hands continued to twitch and writhe, even after the rest of his body had been totally submerged. Then Relg drew his arms out of the stone, leaving the Grolem behind. The two hands, sticking out of the rock, opened once in mute supplication, then stiffened into dead claws. Behind him, Geryon could hear the muffled sound of Silk's retching. Barak and Mandarallan had by now engaged two of the remaining Murgos, and the sound of clashing sword blades rang in the chill air. The last Murgo, his eyes wide with fright, wheeled his horse and bolted. Without a word, Durnik jerked his axe free of his saddle and galloped after him. Instead of striking the man down, however, Durnik cut across in front of his opponent's horse, turning him, driving him back. The panic-stricken Murgo flailed at his horse's flanks with the flat of his sword, turning away from the grim-faced smith, and plunged at a dead run back up over the ridge, with Durnik close behind him. The last two Murgos were down by then, and Barak and Mandarallan, both wild-eyed with the exultation of battle, were looking around for more enemies.
"Where's that last one?" Barak demanded.
"Durnik's chasing him," Geryon said.
"We can't let him get away. He'll bring others."
"Durnik's going to take care of it," Belgoroth told him. Barak fretted.
"Durnik's a good man, but he's not really a warrior. Maybe I'd better go help him."
From beyond the ridge, there was a sudden scream of horror, then another. The third cut off quite suddenly, and there was silence. After several minutes, Durnik came riding back alone, his face somber.
"What happened? He didn't get away, did he?"
Durnik shook his head.
"I chased him into the bog. He ran into some quicksand."
"Why didn't you cut him down with your axe?"
"I don't really like hitting people," Durnik replied.
Sulk was staring at Durnik, his face still ashen.
"So you just chased him into the quicksand, and then stood there and watched him go down? Durnik, that's monstrous."
"Dead is dead," Durnik told him, with uncharacteristic bluntness. "When it's over, doesn't really matter how it happened now, does it?"
He looked a bit thoughtful.
"I am sorry about the horse, though."
Chapter 24 The next morning, they followed the ridge line that angled off toward the east. The wintry sky above them was an icy blue, and there was no warmth to the sun. Relg kept his eyes veiled against the light and muttered prayers as he rode to ward off his panic. Several times they saw dust clouds far out on the desolation of sand and salt flats to the south. But they were unable to determine whether the clouds were caused by Murgo patrols or vagrant wind. About noon, the wind shifted and blew in steadily from the south. A ponderous cloud, black as ink, blotted out the jagged line of peaks lying along the southern horizon. It moved toward them with a kind of ominous inexorability, and flickers of lightning glimmered in its sooty underbelly.
"There's a bad storm coming, Belgoroth," Barak rumbled, staring at the cloud.
Belgoroth shook his head.
"It's not a storm. It's ashfall. That volcano out there is erupting again, and the wind is blowing the ash this way."
Barak made a face and then shrugged.
"At least we won't have to worry about being seen once it starts."
"The Grolems won't be looking for us with their eyes, Barak," Aunt Paul reminded him.
Belgoroth scratched at his beard.
"We will have to take steps to deal with that, I suppose."
"This is a large group to shield, Father," Aunt Paul pointed out. "And that's not even counting the horses."
"I think you can manage it, Paul. You were always very good at it."
"I can hold up my side as long as you can hold up yours, old wolf."
"I am afraid I'm not going to be able to help you, Paul. Tuchik himself is looking for us. I have felt him several times already, and I'm going to have to concentrate on him. If he decides to strike at us, he will come very fast. I'll have to be ready for him, and I cannot do that if I am all tangled up in a shield."
"I can't do it alone, Father. Nobody can enclose this many men and horses without help."
"Geryon can help you."
"Me?"
Geryon jerked his eyes off of the looming cloud to stare at his grandfather.
"He's never done it before, Father," Aunt Paul pointed out.
"He's going to have to learn sometime."
"This is hardly the time or place for experimentation."
"He will do just fine. Walk him through it a time or two until he gets the hang of it."
"Exactly what is that I'm supposed to do?" Geryon asked apprehensively.
Aunt Paul gave Belgoroth a hard look and then turned to Geryon.
"I'll show you, dear. The first thing you have to do is to stay calm. It really isn't all that difficult." "But you just said..." "Never mind what I said, dear. Now just pay attention." "What do you want me to do?" "The first thing is to relax," she replied. "And think about sand and rock. That's all. Just do that first. Concentrate."
He thought about sand and rock.
No, Geryon, not white sand. Black sand. Like the sand all around us. Well, you didn't say that. I didn't think I had to.
Belgareth started to laugh.
Do you want to do this, father?
She demanded crossly. And then she turned back to Geryon.
Do it again, dear. Try to get it right this time.
He fixed it in his mind.
That's better,
she told him.
Now, as soon as you get sand and rock firmly in your mind, I want you to sort of push the idea in a half circle out from you so that it covers your entire right side. I'll take care of the left.
He strained with it. It was the hardest thing he had ever done.
Don't push quite so hard, Geryon. You're wrinkling it. And it's very hard for me to make the seams match when you do that. Just keep it steady and smooth.
I'm sorry. He smoothed it out.
How does it look, father?
She asked the old man. Geryon felt a tentative push against the idea he was holding.
Yeah, not bad at all, Paul. Not bad at all. The boy's got talent.
Just exactly what are we doing?
Geryon asked. In spite of the chill, he felt sweat standing out on his forehead.
You are making a shield, Belgareth told him. You enclose yourself in the idea of sand and rock, and it merges with the real sand and rock all around us. When Grolems go looking for things with their minds, they are looking for men and horses. They will sweep right past us, because all they will see here is more sand and more rock.
That's all there is to it.
Geryon was quite pleased with how simple it was.
There is a bit more, dear, Aunt Paul said. We're going to extend it now so that it covers all of us. Go out slowly, a few feet at a time.
That was much less simple. He tore the fabric of the idea several times before he got it pushed out as far as Aunt Paul wanted it. He felt a strange merging of his mind with hers along the center of the idea where the two sides joined.
I think we've got it now, father, Aunt Paul said.
I told you he could do it, Paul.
The purple-black cloud was rolling ominously up the sky toward them, and faint rumbles of thunder growled along its leading edge.
If that ash is anything like what it was in the Issa, we're going to be wandering blind out here, Belgareth,
Marak said.
Don't worry about it, the sorcerer replied. I have got a lock on Rachthol. The Grolems are not the only ones who can locate things that way. Let's move out.
They started along the ridge again as the cloud blotted out the sky overhead. The thunder shocks were a continuous rumble, and lightning seethed in the boiling cloud. The lightning had an arid, crackling quality about it as the billions of tiny particles seethed and churned, building enormous static discharges. Then the first specks of drifting ash began to settle down through the icy air as Belgareth led them down off of the ridge and out onto the sand flats. By the end of the first hour, Geryon found that holding the image in his mind had grown easier. It was no longer necessary to concentrate all of his attention on it as it had been at first. By the end of the second hour, it had become no more than tedious. To relieve the boredom of it as they rode through the thickening ashfall, he thought about one of the huge skeletons they had passed when they had first entered the wasteland. Painstakingly, he constructed one of them and placed it in the image he was holding. On the whole, he thought it looked rather good, and it gave him something to do.
Geryon, Aunt Paul said crisply, please do not try to be creative.
Oh, what?
Just stick to sand. Oh, the skeleton's very nice, but it looks a bit peculiar with only one side.
One side?
There wasn't a skeleton on my side of the image, just yours. Now keep it simple, Geryon. Don't embellish.
They rode on, their faces muffled to keep the choking ash out of their mouths and noses. Geryon felt a tentative push against the image he was holding. It seemed to flutter against his mind, feeling almost like the wriggling touch of the tadpoles he had once caught in the pond at Faldor's farm.
"Hold it steady, Geryon," Aunt Paul warned. "That's a Grolem." "Did he see us?"
"No. There now. He's moving on."
And the fluttering touch was gone. They spent the night in another of the piles of broken rock that dotted the wasteland. Durnick once again devised a kind of low, hollowed-out shelter of piled rock and anchored down tent cloth. They took a cold supper of bread and dried meat and built no fire. Garion and Aunt Paul took turns holding the image of empty sand over them like an umbrella. He discovered that it was much easier when they were not moving. The ash was still falling the next morning, but the sky was no longer the inky black it had been the day before.
"I think it's thinning out, Belgareth," Silk said, as they saddled their horses. "If it blows over, we'll have to start dodging patrols again."
The old man nodded.
"We'd better hurry," he agreed.
"There's a place I know of where we can hide, about 5 miles north of the city. I'd like to get there before this ashfall subsides. You can see for 10 leagues in any direction from the walls of Rachthol."
"Are the walls so high, then?"
Mandarallan asked. "Higher than you can imagine. Higher even than the walls of Vomimbre. 10 times higher, 50 times higher. You will have to see it to understand."
They rode hard that day. Garion and Aunt Paul held their shield of thought in place, but the searching touches of the Grolems came more frequently now. Several times the push against Garion's mind was very strong and came without warning.
"They know what we are doing, Father," Aunt Paul told the old man. "They are trying to penetrate the screen."
"Hold it firm," he replied. "You'll know what to do if one of them breaks through."
She nodded, her face grim.
"Warn the boy."
She nodded again, then turned to Garion.
"Listen to me carefully, dear," she said gravely.
"The Grolems are trying to take us by surprise. The best shield in the world can be penetrated if you hit it quickly enough and hard enough. If one of them does manage to break through, I'm going to tell you to stop. When I say stop, I want you to erase the image immediately and put your mind completely away from it."
"I don't understand."
"You don't have to. Just do exactly as I say. If I tell you to stop, pull your thoughts out of contact with mine instantly. I'll be doing something that's very dangerous, and I don't want you to get hurt."
"Can't I help?"
"No, dear. Not this time."
They rode on. The ashfall grew even thinner, and the sky overhead turned a hazy yellowish blue. The ball of the sun, pale and round like a full moon, appeared not far above the southwestern horizon.
"Garion, stop!"
What came was not a push, but a sharp stab. Garion gasped and jerked his mind away, throwing the image of sand from him. Aunt Paul stiffened, and her eyes were blazing. Her hand flickered a short gesture, and she spoke a single word. The surge Garion felt as her will unleashed was overpowering. With a momentary dismay, he realized that his mind was still linked to hers. The merging that had held the image together was too strong, too complete to break. He felt himself drawn with her as their still-joined minds lashed out like a whip. They flashed back along the faint trail of thought that had stabbed at the shield and found its origin. They touched another mind, a mind filled with the exaltation of discovery. Then, sure of her target now, Aunt Paul struck with the full force of her will. The mind they had touched flinched back, trying to break off the contact, but it was too late for that now. Garion could feel the other mind swelling, expanding unbearably. Then it suddenly burst, exploding into gibbering insanity, shattering as horror upon horror overwhelmed it. There was flight then, blind, shrieking flight across the dark stones of some kind, a flight with a single thought of dreadful final escape. The stones were gone, and there was a terrible sense of falling from some incalculable height. Garion wrenched his mind away from it.
"I told you to get clear," Aunt Paul snapped at him. "I couldn't help it. I couldn't get loose."
"What happened?" Silk's face was startled.
"A Grolem broke through," she replied.
"Did he see us?"
"For a moment. It doesn't matter. He is dead now."
"You killed him? How?"
"He forgot to defend himself." I followed his thought back.
"He went crazy,"
Garion said in a choked voice, still filled with the horror of the encounter.
"He jumped off something very high. He wanted to jump.
It was the only way he could escape from what was happening to him.
Geryon felt sick. It was awfully noisy, Paul, Belgareth said with a pained expression. You haven't been that clumsy in years.
I had this passenger. She gave Geryon an icy look. Well, it wasn't my fault, Geryon protested. You were holding on so tight that I couldn't break loose. You had us all tied together.
You do that sometimes, Paul, Belgareth told her. The contact gets a little too personal, and you seem to want to take up permanent residence. It has to do with love, I imagine. Do you have any idea what they are talking about? Barak asked Silk.
I would not even want to guess, he replied. And Paul was looking thoughtfully at Geryon. Perhaps it was my fault, she admitted finally.
You are going to have to let go some day, Paul, Belgareth said gravely.
Perhaps, but not just yet.
You had better put the screen back up, the old man suggested. They know we are out here now. There will be others looking for us.
She nodded. Think about sand again, Geryon. The ash continued to settle as they rode through the afternoon, obscuring less and less with each passing mile. They were able to make out the shapes of the jumbled piles of rock around them and a few rounded spires of basalt thrusting up out of the sand.
As they approached another of the low rock ridges that cut across the wasteland at regular intervals, Geryon saw something dark and enormously high looming in the haze ahead of them. We can hide here until dark, Belgareth said, dismounting behind the ridge. Are we there? Drenik asked, looking around. That is Rakhthal.
The old man pointed at the ominous shadow.
Barak squinted at it. I thought that was just a mountain. It is. Rakhthal's built on top of it. It's almost like Prolgo, then, isn't it? The locations are similar, but Tuchek, the magician, lives here. It makes it quite different from Prolgo.
I thought Tuchek was a sorcerer, Geryon said, puzzled. Why do you keep calling him a magician?
It is a term of contempt, Belgareth replied. It is considered a deadly insult in our particular society.
They picketed their horses among some large rocks on the back side of the ridge and climbed the 40 or so feet to the top, where they took cover to watch and wait for nightfall. As the settling ash thinned even more, the peak began to emerge from the haze. It was not so much a mountain as a rock pinnacle towering up out of the wasteland. Its base, surrounded by a mass of shattered rubble, was fully 5 miles around, and its sides were sheer and black as night.
How high does it reach? Mandarallan asked, his voice dropping almost unconsciously into a half-whisper. Somewhat more than a mile, Belgareth replied.
A steep causeway rose sharply from the floor of the wasteland to encircle the upper 1,000 or so feet of the Black Tower.
I imagined that took a while to build,
Barak noted.
About 1,000 years, Belgareth answered. While it was under construction, the Muggles bought every slave the Nissans could put their hands on. A grim business, Mandarallan observed. It is a grim place, Belgareth agreed.
As the chill breeze blew off of the last of the haze, the shape of the city perched atop the crag began to emerge. The walls were as black as the sides of the pinnacle, and black turrets jutted out from them, seemingly at random. Dark spires rose within the walls, stabbing up into the evening sky like spears. There was a foreboding, evil air about the black city of the Grolems. It perched, brooding atop its peak, looking out over the savage wasteland of sand, rock, and sulfur-reeking bogs that encircled it. The sun, sinking into the banks of clouds and ash along the jagged western rim of the wasteland, bathed the grim fortress above them in a sooty crimson glow. The walls of Rakhthal seemed to bleed. It was as if all of the blood that had been spilled on the altars of Torak since the world began had been gathered together to stain the dread city above them,
and that all of the oceans of the world would not be enough to wash it clean again. Chapter 25. As the last trace of light slid from the sky, they moved carefully down off of the ridge and crossed the ash-covered sand toward the rock tower looming above them. When they reached the shattered scree at the base, they dismounted, left the horses with Durnick, and climbed up the steeply sloped rubble to the rock face of the basalt pinnacle that blotted out the stars. Although Relg had been shuddering and hiding his eyes a moment before, he moved almost eagerly now. He stopped, and then carefully placed his hands and forehead against the icy rock.
"Well?" Belgareth asked after a moment, his voice hushed, but carrying a note of dreadful concern. "Was I right? Are there caves?"
"There are open spaces," Relg replied. "They're a long way inside."
"Can you get to them?"
"There's no point. They don't go anywhere. They're just closed-in hollows."
"Now what?" Sulk asked.
"I don't know," Belgareth admitted, sounding terribly disappointed.
"Let's try a little farther around," Rog suggested. "I can feel some echoes here. There might be something off in that direction," he pointed.
"I want one thing clearly understood right here and now," Silk announced, planting his feet firmly. "I am not going to go through any more rock. If there's going to be any of that, I'll stay behind."
"We'll come up with something," Barak told him.
Silk shook his head stubbornly. "No passing through rock," he declared stubbornly. Relg was already moving along the face, his fingers lightly touching the basalt.
"It's getting stronger," he told them. "It's large and it goes up."
He moved on another 100 yards or so, and they followed, watching him intently.
"It's right through here," he said finally, patting the rock face with one hand. "It might be the one we want.
Wait here."
He put his hands against the rock and pushed them slowly into the basalt.
"Oh, I can't stand this," Silk said, turning his back quickly. "Let me know once he's inside."
With a kind of dreadful determination, Relg pushed his way into the rock.
"Is he gone yet?" Silk asked.
"He's going in," Barak replied clinically. "Only half of him is still sticking out."
"Please, Barak, don't tell me about it."
"Was it really that bad?"
the big man asked. "Oh, you have no idea. You have absolutely no idea."
The rat-faced man was shivering uncontrollably. They waited in the chill darkness for half an hour or more. Somewhere high above them there was a scream.
"What was that cry?"
Mandarallan asked.
"The Grolums are busy,"
Belgareth answered grimly.
"It is the season of the wounding, when the Aur burned Torak's hand and face. A large number of sacrifices are called for at this time of year, usually slaves. Torak does not seem to insist on Angarak blood. As long as it is human, it seems to satisfy him."
There was a faint sound of steps somewhere along the cliff, and a few moments later, Relg rejoined them.
"I found it," he told them. "The opening's about a half mile further along. It is partially blocked."
"Does it go all the way up?"
Belgareth demanded. Relg shrugged.
"It goes up. I can't say how far. The only way to find out for sure is to follow it. The whole series of caves is fairly extensive, though."
"Do we really have any choice, Father?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"No, I suppose not."
"I'll go get Durnick," Silk said.
He turned and disappeared into the darkness. The rest of them followed Relg until they reached a small hole in the rock face just above the tumbled scree.
"We'll have to move some of this rubble if we're going to get the animals inside," he told them.
Barak bent and lifted a large stone block.
He staggered under its weight and dropped it to one side with a clatter.
Quietly, Belgorath told him. Sorry,
Barak mumbled. For the most part, the stones were not large, but there were a great many of them. When Silk and Durnik joined them, they all fell to clearing the rubble out of the cave mouth. It took them nearly an hour to remove enough rock to make it possible for the horses to squeeze through.
I wish Hetar was here,
Barak grunted, putting his shoulder against the rump of a bulky pack horse.
Talk to him, Barak, Silk suggested.
I am talking.
Try it without all of those swear words.
There's going to be some climbing involved,
Rug told them, after they had pushed the last horse inside and stood in the total blackness of the cave.
As nearly as I can tell, the galleries run vertically, so we'll have to climb from level to level.
Mandarallan leaned against one of the walls and his armor clanked.
Belgorath told him, That's not going to work. You wouldn't be able to climb in armor anyway. Leave it here with the horses, Mandarallan.
The knight sighed and began removing his armor. A faint glow appeared as Relg mixed powders in a wooden bowl from two leather pouches he carried inside his mail shirt.
That's better, Barak approved. But wouldn't the torch be brighter?
Much brighter, Relg agreed. But then I wouldn't be able to see. This will give you enough light to see where you're going.
Let's get started, then, Belgorath said.
Relg handed the glowing bowl to Barak and turned to lead them up a dark gallery. After they had gone a few hundred yards, they came to a steep slope of rubble rising up into the darkness.
I'll look, Relg said, and scrambled up the slope out of sight.
After a moment or so, they heard a peculiar popping sound, and tiny fragments of rock showered down onto the rubble from above.
Come up now, Relg's voice came to them.
Carefully they climbed the rubble until they reached a sheer wall.
To your right, Relg said, still above them. You'll find some holes in the rock you can use to climb up.
They found the holes quite round and about 6 inches deep.
How'd you make these?
Durnik asked, examining one of the holes.
It's a bit difficult to explain, Relg replied. There's a ledge up here. It leads to another gallery.
One by one, they climbed the rock face to join Relg on the ledge. As he had told them, the ledge led to a gallery that angled sharply upward. They followed it toward the center of the peak, passing several passageways opening to the sides.
Shouldn't we see where they go?
Barak asked after they had passed the third or fourth passageway.
They don't go any place, Relg told him.
How can you be sure?
A gallery that goes someplace feels different. But the one we just passed comes to a blank wall about 100 feet in.
Barak grunted dubiously.
They came to another sheer face, and Relg stopped to peer up into the blackness.
How high is it?
Durnik asked.
30 feet or so. I'll make some holes so we can climb up.
Relg knelt and slowly pushed one hand into the face of the rock. Then he tensed his shoulder and twisted his arm slightly. The rock popped with a sharp little detonation. When Relg pulled his hand out, a shower of fragments came with it. He brushed the rest of the debris out of the hole he had made, stood up and sank his other hand into the rock, about 2 feet above the first.
Clever,
Silk admired.
It's a very old trick, Relg told him.
They followed Relg up the face and squeezed through a narrow crack at the top. Barak muttered curses as he wriggled through, leaving a fair amount of his skin behind.
"How far have we come?"
Silk asked. His voice had a certain apprehension in it, and he looked about nervously at the rock, which seemed to press in all around them.
"We're about 800 feet above the base of the pinnacle," Relg replied. "We go that way now."
He pointed up another sloping passageway.
"Isn't that back in the direction we just came?"
Durnik asked.
The cave zigzags, Relg told him. We have to keep following the galleries that lead upward.
Do they go all the way to the top?
They open out somewhere. That's all I can tell for sure at this point.
What is that?
Silk cried sharply.
From somewhere along one of the dark passageways, a voice floated out at them, singing. There seemed to be a deep sadness in the song, but the echoes made it impossible to pick out the words. About all they could be sure of was the fact that the singer was a woman. After a moment, Belgarath gave a startled exclamation.
"What's wrong?"
Aunt Paul asked him.
"Merag," the old man said.
"That's impossible."
"I know the song, Paul. It is a Merag funeral song. Whoever she is, she's very close to dying."
The echoes in the twisting passageways made it very difficult to pinpoint the singer's exact location, but as they moved, the sound seemed to be getting closer.
"Down here,"
Silk said finally, stopping with his head cocked to one side in front of an opening. The singing stopped abruptly.
"No closer,"
the unseen woman warned sharply.
"I have a knife."
"We are friends," Dernick called to her. She laughed bitterly at that.
"I have no friends. You're not going to take me back. My knife is long enough to reach my heart."
"She thinks we're Murgos," Silk whispered. Belgarath raised his voice, speaking in a language Geryon had never heard before. After a moment, the woman answered haltingly, as if trying to remember words she had not spoken for years.
"She thinks it's a trick," the old man told them quietly. "She says she's got a knife right against her heart, so we are going to have to be careful."
He spoke again into the dark passageway, and the woman answered him. The language they were speaking was liquid and musical.
"She says she'll let one of us go to her," Belgarath said finally. "She still does not trust us."
"I'll go,"
Aunt Paul told him.
"Be careful, Paul. She might decide at the last minute to use her knife on you instead of herself."
"I can handle it, Father."
Aunt Paul took the light from Barak and moved slowly on down the passageway, speaking calmly as she went. The rest of them stood in the darkness, listening intently to the murmur of voices coming from the passageway as Aunt Paul talked quietly to the Merag woman.
"You can come now,"
she called to them finally, and they went down the passageway toward her voice. The woman was lying beside a small pool of water. She was dressed only in scanty rags, and she was very dirty. Her hair was a lustrous black, but badly tangled, and her face had a resigned, hopeless look on it. She had wide cheekbones, full lips, and huge violet eyes framed with sooty black lashes. The few pitiful rags she wore exposed a great deal of her pale skin. Relg drew in a sharp breath and immediately turned his back.
"Her name is Taiba,"
Aunt Paul told them quietly. "She escaped from the slave pens under Rakhthal several days ago." Belgarath knelt beside the exhausted woman.
"You're a Merag, aren't you?"
he asked her intently.
"My mother, she told me I was,"
she confirmed.
"She is the one who taught me the old language."
Her dark hair fell across one of her pale cheeks in a shadowy tangle.
"Are there any other Merags in the slave pens?"
"A few, I think. It is hard to tell. Most of the other slaves have had their tongues cut out."
"She needs food," Aunt Paul said.
"Did anyone think to bring anything?"
Dernick untied a pouch from his belt and handed it to her.
"Some cheese, a bit of dried meat," he said.
Aunt Paul opened the pouch.
"Have you any idea how your people came to be here?"
Belgarath asked the slave woman.
"Think now. It could be very important."
Taiba shrugged.
"We have always been here."
She took the food Aunt Paul offered to her and began to eat ravenously.
"Not too fast,"
Aunt Paul warned.
"Have you ever heard anything about how Merags wound up in the slave pens of the Murgos?"
Belgarath pressed.
"My mother told me once that thousands of years ago we lived in a country under the open sky, and that we were not slaves then." "I did not believe her, though,"
Taiba replied.
"It is the sort of story that you would tell to children."